Hi, it's Diane. On my mind, where the GOP goes from here. Over the last 4 years, Donald Trump has been the unrivaled leader of the Republican Party. National GOP leaders who spoke out against him often found themselves out of a job. Even now, as the president continues his campaign to undermine the election results, many in his party have remained silent or openly supported his baseless claims of fraud. And Republican voters have stood by President Trump. He maintains an approval rating of nearly 90% among the party faithful. So, what does all this mean for the future of the Republican Party? I asked Jonah Goldberg, longtime conservative commentator, Trump critic, and editor-in-chief of The Dispatch. Jonah, Trump is going down to Georgia this weekend to campaign for the Republican senators in the runoff election, but some think his presence and his claims of voter fraud may actually hurt the Republicans' chances. Do these two sides actually reflect the fight in the GOP right now?
Yes, I think on that level, it is absolutely sort of a microcosm of the larger problem within the GOP. But it's, I mean, if it were just, like, I love conservative intellectual history. I like political history. If it was just two factions of, say, you know, the followers of Taft versus the followers of Goldwater or Nelson Rockefeller versus the Nixonites or whatever, I'd be like, okay, this is fun. This is interesting, right? The problem is that it is a contest between a segment of the party that has truly lost its mind, politically speaking, that is embracing deeply dangerous and pernicious garbage, and I think a larger segment of the party, faction of the party, that rejects this stuff, but for the most part doesn't have the courage to say so publicly. And so it is not a normal intramural or fraternal fight for the Republican Party. It is much more like a fight between the John Birch Society and the traditional GOP, and it depresses me greatly.
Spell that out a little more in terms of how you see these various factions fighting against one another.
Sure. I mean, I'll start narrow. The single most revealing absurdity, I think, of all of this isn't that you have the former national security advisor calling for martial law, which is awful and depressing and incredibly stupid, but the core argument from people like Lynn Wood or Lynn Wells, the lawyer, and Sidney Powell, the two sort of most prominent people on this fight to say the election was stolen, their argument in Georgia is, we must never stop fighting for control of this country to stop the demonic Democratic Party, which will destroy this country through socialism. And that's why you shouldn't vote Republican in this runoff election and give the Senate control to the Democrats. And it's just on its face, whatever you think of the ideological stuff, it's just incredibly stupid and weird. And I think this is what you get when you get a segment of the party that becomes deeply invested in what boils down to being a personality cult of Donald Trump. And not all personality cults are the same. Reagan kind of had a personality cult, to be sure. But what people did with Reagan was people internalized Reagan's articulation and rhetoric of certain principles. And that came to define the Republican Party for a couple decades. What people are doing with Trump is they're internalizing his narcissistic personality disorder and his sense of grievance. And that's all the difference in the world. And I think that's one of the reasons why I want to focus on the asymmetry between these two factions. It is not two factions with different ideological worldviews like Goldwaterites versus Rockefeller Republicans. It is a faction that has subsumed itself to Donald Trump's lizard brain and a larger part of the party that just simply has no idea how to deal with this and is terrified of losing the support of those voters who are more in the other faction.
So, in your opinion, is Trump's visit to Georgia going to help or hurt Republicans?
I'm not trying to dodge it. I just honestly don't know. First of all, it depends what he says. Like, waiting for Donald Trump to act presidential is like waiting for Godot. You know, it never materializes. So the odds of him holding a rally and not turning it into a thing about himself and his personal grievances and the election was stolen stuff seems very unlikely to me. But if he could actually tell his wing of the party, don't listen to these people saying, don't vote, we need you to vote, it could help Perdue and Loeffler to a certain extent. The real interesting question to me, which I don't know what the answer is one of the most interesting data points coming out of the presidential election is that turnout in cities wasn't that large among African-American voters. And that vote matters a lot in Atlanta, you know, and in Georgia. The real swing here was suburban white women. And in fact, Donald Trump improved his standing in most urban areas and lost because he hurt himself in suburban areas. And so the question is, if that's the trend, does Donald Trump showing up once again turn off those white suburban women who just, among other things, don't like the drama that he brings? And if that's the case, I could see it hurting Loeffler and Perdue considerably. But in a normal situation, you would just assume that the Republican Party has a major structural advantage and would win a runoff like this under normal times, because it's still basically a Republican state, even though it's heading towards purple. But these are not normal times.
What about the fact that Trump has now publicly stated he is going to run again in 2024? How does that affect what Republicans as a whole think and do going forward?
I wrote about this recently in a column. You know, one of the reasons why we got Trump the first time is that the Republican Party was paralyzed by what is called in game theory, it's named after possibly a Aesop's fable, belling the cat problem, where in the parable, everybody, it's in every mouse's interest to put a bell on the cat so that they know when the cat is coming so they don't get killed. But it is in no individual mouse's interest to be the one to put the bell on the cat. And so in the 2016 primaries, we saw Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio and all these people avoid the problem that Donald Trump was becoming, because they figured he would kill all the other mice first and then they would win a one-on-one contest. And no one really took on Trump until it was too late. And what Trump does by announcing or at least leading people to believe that he's going to run again in 2024 is you have the belling the cat problem all over again. The problem is it's much harder now, and or at least it's much harder right now. And so it basically, like, I'm fairly confident that Tom Cotton and Nikki Haley and Mike Pence, all these people want to be president of the United States and they would like to be president in 2024, but it's in none of their individual interests to be the first person to pretend that Trump doesn't have a divine right to that, to the presidential office again. So they all have to sort of pretend that they're somehow meekly supportive of Trump, or at least not get him angry at them, and hope that somebody else jumps in and starts the process of a competitive race. But at least for the next year, unless Trump does something even crazier that really disqualifies him in the public's eyes, it freezes the GOP presidential part of it in place indefinitely.
They're all going to stand back and wait for that first brave soul to step up and say, I'm going to run.
Whether they would call him a brave soul or a sucker, remains to be seen. You know, what is the Japanese phrase about how the nail that stands tallest gets the hammer? I think that they want someone else to be the human shield in this case against Trump. And at the same time, I just still find it somewhat implausible that 4 years from now, a 78, 79-year-old Donald Trump is actually going to run and win again. And I would like to think we live in one of the universes where that obvious fact seems obvious to other people, but it maybe I'm wrong.
Joan, is this election truly over, or is Trump likely to get a hearing before the Supreme Court?
I would put odds of Donald Trump having a second term, you know, and Joe Biden not being president, at about 0.0001%, maybe something along those lines. Maybe you got to throw a couple more zeros in there. The odds of the Supreme Court saying something are better than that, 5%, something like that, but they're still not good. And the odds of the Supreme Court coming to Donald Trump's rescue in any meaningful way, I think, are back down towards 1%. Justice Roberts has made it very clear he wants nothing to do with this. He's made it very clear that he is just going to sit on his hands during the Trump presidency, and I guarantee you he's happy that it's about to end. And it's difficult to exaggerate how unbelievably incompetent the president's legal efforts have been so far, and how scant the evidence is on their side to begin with, which may help explain some of the incompetence. So the idea that the Supreme Court is going to manufacture something that the evidence isn't there, that the lower courts couldn't see, I just think it's a fantasy. I mean, this, I know there were people with very strong opinions on both sides of the Florida recount in 2000, but that was a much different set of facts. It was a much narrower question. And I think 20 years later, partisans can understand that there were, at the minimum, good arguments on both sides of that. I actually think the Supreme Court got it right, at least in the decision that went 7-2. And this is not that. This would be trying to get the whole Supreme Court to, in effect, steal the election for a president who lost. I think, I'm sorry to filibuster here, but I often say, you know, what if this was Obama is the lowest form of punditry? And when President Obama was president, I used to say, what if this was Bush is the lowest form of punditry? And what I mean by that is not that asking that question is wrong or that it's not revealing. It's just that it's so easy. And at the same time, if President Obama in 2012 had attempted anything remotely like what Donald Trump is attempting here, you would have major conservatives saying, we need to explore our quote-unquote Second Amendment remedies. This is why we have a Second Amendment. This is leading to civil war. This is outrageous. The president lost to Mitt Romney, and he's trying to steal the election. And I got to say, I think conservatives would have a point. I'm not in favor of violence in any way or all that kind of stuff. But stealing an election is a first-order outrage. And what Trump is trying to do, or at least keep his options open to be able to do, is to try and steal an election. And it's shameful that no one's pointing it out on the right.
Why is he continuing then to claim victory? What is his end goal?
You know, I'm a Fox News contributor. I'm not on much these days for perhaps obvious reasons. But the scuttlebutt is, I mean, I'm sure you've heard, there's been lots written about it, is that he wants to start his own media platform. I'm not sure he's actually going to start his own television network. It's too expensive to do that, and that in an era of cord cutting, it's going to be very difficult to borrow $1 billion or $1.5 billion from somebody to let you do that. But maybe he'll have a straight to internet streaming thing. He may borrow from the populace of the 1930s and do just peripatetic road shows where he, you know, does his shtick as political rallies. But I think, as with everything with Donald Trump, and I've been having this argument for 4 years with my conservative friends, is that Trumpism is not an ideological thing. It is a psychological thing. And the Trump psychology and the psychology that he elicits from his followers is vastly more important than anything about ideas or ideology. And for Trump, this allows him to walk around among sycophants and have them all say he won. And that's what he really wants. He doesn't want to have to say the words that he lost. He doesn't want to admit that he's the biggest loser. And he is willing to tear down traditions and institutions and the Republican Party in order to be able to walk through the lobby of Mar-a-Lago without blushing. And it's shameful.
So going forward, assuming, as we all do, that President-elect Joe Biden is inaugurated on January 20, what does the Republican Party do going forward? I realize a lot depends on that Georgia election. But even without that Georgia election, are there some within the GOP who may try to move in a compromising way to at least accomplish some things with the new president?
I think so. And here, I think James Madison was a better philosopher than Alexander Hamilton, but Hamilton was a better rapper. And Madison, one of the genius things that Madison created was the structure of our separations of powers, our sort of not just at the national level, but at the state level. And one of the things that the Madisonian system sets up is a system where when you have two very partisan power centers, it actually empowers the center. And so like Joe Manchin, 2 weeks ago said he wasn't going to be part of court packing and all that. And because when you have a tightly polarized, tightly divided government, the people who are able to go vote with the majority or stay with the minority or create majorities have all of the power by definition. And so we're seeing this with the stimulus about the COVID response. Mitt Romney and a bunch of essentially moderates, at least for their own parties, are arguing in good faith about what they can live with to get something passed. And that, I think, is not only a testament to the genius of the system, but is a reason for some hopefulness in that regard. I mean, Susan Collins is now a vastly more powerful senator than Ted Cruz is, because Ted Cruz is bound by his own rhetoric and his own base and all of that. And Susan Collins won despite being a critic of Trump. And so people like her, people like Mitt Romney, people even like Ben Sasse have the ability to be outside of the bunker, as it were. And I also just think that Joe Biden, to his credit, I've never been a huge fan of Joe Biden. Joe Biden seems to understand that swinging for the fences, A, isn't going to work, and B, is just going to further divide the country. And going for small, serious, substantial successes is probably in his own best interest. And so I'm more hopeful on that front, or at least optimistic.
A quick break. When we come back, more of my conversation with Jonah Goldberg. Here's the rest of my conversation with Jonah Goldberg, editor-in-chief of The Dispatch. Jonah, you've likened Trump's actions post-election to those of Joe McCarthy. Talk about how you see that and why.
Sure. I come from a decidedly anti-communist family. One of my father's only hobbies other than going to museums or the other side of the couch to read a different book was to talk about how bad Stalin was. So I want to be clear about this. I'm an anti-communist, come from that tradition. But on the right, there's always been a debate about Joe McCarthy. Was he a hero of the cause, or did he set back the cause? And the weight of opinion on the right has moved to the fact that what I think is true is he basically set back the cause. And the reason he did so was that he was a dishonorable person. He trafficked in slander. He made up evidence. You know, the list of communists in the government that he had, the number changed over the course of the day from speech to speech. He was a bully and a demagogue, and he discredited the cause at a time when I think the cause was a worthy one, even though there were obvious McCarthyite excesses. Donald Trump is very much like a McCarthyite. He cares primarily about himself. He's definitely a demagogue. He makes up facts. He makes up allegations. He deals in innuendo. We knew this from 2016. You know, I mean, he's out there talking about Ted Cruz's dad killing Kennedy. This is not a shocking revelation. And I think that the dismaying part is that, as I was saying earlier about Trumpism being a psychological phenomenon, it has infected a large swath of the party itself. There have always been crazy people on the fringes of the Republican Party and crazy people on the fringes of the Democratic Party. And conspiracy theories, anti-vax, all that kind of stuff, they don't really have an ideological home. They cross over. But when the president, particularly one who benefits from such a cult of personality, traffics in this stuff, retweets this stuff, it gives a very powerful signal. It gives permission structure for all sorts of people to believe it too. And then it becomes a loyalty test. If you don't believe that the lizard people stole the election for the Democrats, you're not a real conservative. You're not a Republican. You're not truly supportive of Trump. I mean, William Barr, the attorney general, carried more water than Gunga Din for Donald Trump for years. And then all of a sudden he just tells the truth in a very low key way. And all of a sudden the sort of the Seb Gorkas and Steve Bannon world and all that, they call him a traitor. He's in on it. He's part of the deep state. He's one of the lizard people. And that's that paranoid style, that psychosis, which informed a lot of anti-communism on the fringes, has just reasserted itself as anti-Democrat and pro-Trumpism under Trump. And it's going to take a long time to fumigate the place.
And what happened with McCarthy was that finally, responsible people within his own party called him out. But it doesn't seem as though, except for Mitt Romney to a certain extent, Susan Collins a little bit, who's there to do that?
Yeah, I got to say, the people who had the best Joe Welch moments, right? That was Joseph, that was the Ms. McCarthy at long last Have You No Shame from the 1950s. Have been these local election officials. This guy in Georgia, I apologize for not remembering his name, that was real speaking truth to power. And he's a serious conservative Republican. And so is the Secretary of State in Georgia. And I think one of the things is that those people who are close to the reality on the ground, simply for their own consciences, cannot participate in something that says that they were part of some grand conspiracy or they let some horrible thing happen and it forces better behavior. Also, being subject to death threats and horrible harassment focuses the mind as well. I'm not trying to belittle what they're doing. I think it's courageous and right. I think the differences between now and the 1950s are so profound. They did surveys where, 70, 80% of the people believed that the government was going to do the right thing. So most of the time, back in the 50s and 60s, there was a real trust in institutions, the people leading the government. And the president of the United States during the McCarthy era was Eisenhower.
Yeah.
And you could not get particularly panicked about the country going off the rails with Eisenhower in the Oval Office. There's a real difference between, it's not a perfect analogy, but today, it's like Eisenhower is the senator from Utah and McCarthy is the president of the United States. And the 1950s would have looked very different under those circumstances. And that's not even accounting for the lack of faith and trust in institutions or the deep polarization we have in our country. People forget that the Democrats for a long time wanted Eisenhower to run as a Democrat. He was a unifying figure in our culture in ways that we haven't had in a very long time and may not have again in our lifetimes.
So if you think about how this moves forward, a lot depends on what Donald Trump does in the future, how he behaves, what he does, whether he continues to hold that psyche of that portion of the American public who voted for him. In the meantime, how many Republicans or what portion of Republicans on the Hill understand that the country needs to move forward without Donald Trump leading them?
I think more than their silence would suggest. I've spoken to many senators and congressmen over the last 4 years. Very few Republican ones, very few of them are fans of Donald Trump. They're afraid of his voters. They're part of the problem that we have is I've come to the position that I basically don't like primaries. And because primaries distort and because of polarization, self-sorting, most Republicans and most Democrats are more afraid of a primary challenge than they are of a general election challenge. And when you're more afraid of a primary challenge, the incentive structure is completely wrong, right? In the politics that we both grew up with, the whole idea was we would see Democrats move a little left during the primaries to get the nomination and then move to the center because that's where the majority makers were. Same thing with Republicans. They move a little right, then they come back to the center because that's where the majority makers were. Now, if everything is a base election, you don't care about the marginal voter in the middle nearly as much. You care about turning out as many people from your own side. And both parties, whether it's Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez or Ted Cruz, they subscribe to these churn out the base models for politics, which involve, attacking the other side rather than trying to work with it. That said, there are a lot of Republicans, including a lot of Republican senators, who very much would like to get back to something like regular order, so the trick is, and I think a lot of them are hoping for, is that with Trump out of office and no longer using Fox as the venue he once did, because he's now decided that Fox is an enemy rather than a friend, and so he's going to be off in the swampier parts of Newsmax or OAN or whatever those things are, that they can start doing something more like normal politics, particularly because Trump won't have the megaphone, Trump won't have the institutional power because he's not president, and slowly but surely, by the time you get to 2022, never mind 2024, Trump is more in the rearview mirror than he is in the windshield. But it's going to be very ugly for the first 6 months or a year under the best case scenario.
So you mentioned that you are a Fox contributor and that Fox has become a target for Trump now. Explain why that has happened, considering the leadership at Fox and how that may evolve once he's out of office.
Yeah, so I mean, with the caveat that, you know, I'm not going to say anything that gets me canceled from Fox right now, but I think that it is an obvious fact that the opinion side, basically the primetime shows, plus Fox and Friends, which a lot of people don't know is not part of the news division. It's part of the opinion or entertainment division at Fox, the same division that runs Hannity and Tucker and Laura, that those parts of Fox, the opinion side of Fox, just went all in to one extent or another with Donald Trump, not to mention the opinion guys at Fox Business, which make like Sean Hannity, like Lou Dobbs makes Sean Hannity look like Jeff Flake. But I think part of what happened is that Donald Trump convinced himself that he was not getting, that Fox was insufficiently loyal to him. I think that probably has to do with the expansion of his ego and the expectance of total support. Than it has to do with actually Fox being all that critical of Donald Trump during his presidency. And he didn't like that the news side was never as sycophantic as he thought it should be. And then what really sort of drove – so this has been a long-standing problem that he's had. And then what really drove him off the edge was the Fox News decision desk, where I have some friends who work there that I respect a great deal, calling Arizona early on election night. And that, this is my own theory, this is not anybody, well, there are other people who agree with me, but I think one of the reasons why Trump got so angry about that is that their plan was always, if the election was close, to try to essentially steal the election with lawsuits and lawyers and all of that. And that plan could only work if it was really close and just boiled down to Pennsylvania. And it didn't happen that way. They lost too many swing states, but they didn't know that at the time. All they knew is that Fox called Arizona, which ruined the narrative. They wanted to go to bed saying, we're winning, we've won. And then in the morning say, oh, no, these late votes don't count, blah, 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 and claim and declare victory. And Fox kind of ruined that plan by calling Arizona early. And since then, at least on the news side, the opinion side, you can find problems. On the news side, they're telling the truth. I mean, I still step up and defend the news side quite often. They're saying there's no evidence for what Trump is saying. There's no evidence that the election was stolen. They do more debunking of the various conspiracy theories than a lot of the networks do, and that drives them crazy. And so now the fever swamp people, who have been for a very long time more about Newsmax and OANN and all these places that have had as a business model to outfox Fox, right? To be the caricature that everybody thinks Fox is. This is their moment in the sun. And so Newsmax and OAN and to a lesser extent, places like The Blaze, whatever, and Sinclair Radio, they are going all in on being Trump maximalists because they think what they can do is cleave off some of Fox's audience, which for their bottom lines would be huge. I think there are a lot of people at Fox, not just tell tales out of school, that very much look forward to this happening. Because those, speaking for myself and for some other people I've talked to about this inside and outside of Fox, you know, the audience that is addicted to 100% Trump conspiracy theories is not the audience that, you know, Charmin Paper Towels wants to advertise with anyway. And getting back Fox's reputation as being, you know, right of center, but not crazy, is these kinds of fights are actually good for Fox. So at least on the news side, I think there are a lot of people who are looking forward to this great new schism where, you know, people at Newsmax claim that, you know, Fox is part of the deep state and they were, you know, they were part of the conspiracy and all along, because that is actually credentializing for them. So are attacks from Trump. And being the boogeyman of the Trump world is probably good for Fox's bottom line and its credibility and its brand.
What do you think happens to an extreme group like QAnon with Trump's defeat?
Well, I mean, this is the great problem with conspiracy theories, is they're non-falsifiable. Our listeners can't see, but I'm holding up in tribute to you my morning edition coffee mug. And you can't prove me wrong, right? I mean, it's proving a negative. And similarly, QAnon is impervious to reason, which should be obvious to people once they start talking about how the government was run by blood-drinking pedophiles. That should have been a good sign, too. And so I think QAnon might fizzle a little bit. My better sense is that it will splinter into different factions of QAnon. It depends a little how much oxygen Trump continues to give it. But the paranoid style, whatever QAnon is, QAnon is just sort of a placeholder for that mindset. That mindset, much to my chagrin, is much more prominent on the right than it's ever been in my life. And will, even if it starts going away right now, will have a long half-life, because, you know, we had a member of QAnon elected to Congress. We have places like Gateway Pundit and some of these websites that, as part of their business model, whether they're pro QAnon or not, their business model is to flood the zone with, as to paraphrase Steve Bannon, fecal matter, and hype up people's sense of paranoia, sense of grievance, the unrealness of politics. They want to heighten that sense in everybody. And that business model, that incentive structure, is going to be there even if QAnon folds up shop tomorrow.
One last question for you. Your thoughts in terms of what we've seen so far about Biden's appointments, his cabinet?
So far, I think they're fine. You know, I mean, like, I'm not a Democrat. And I think that the fight over Neera Tanden going to OMB is basically chum for cable news. I would not want Neera Tanden running OMB if I were president of the United States and all the rest. But it's one of these inside the beltway fights that gives people something to fight about. And maybe she's a sacrificial lamb and blah, 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 blah. But Janet Yellen is a perfectly honorable, good, substantive pick. She's a reassuring pick. You know, I've been trying to explain to a lot of my friends on the right prior to the election that a vote for, and I did not vote for Biden. I wrote in Mitch Daniels, just so you know. But you know, so many people had convinced themselves that as much as they dislike Trump, and a lot of conservatives really do dislike Trump, they couldn't vote for Biden because Biden's the stalking horse for socialism and blah, 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 blah. And I was like, I don't think he is. I think he's sort of a typical older Democrat who's sort of, you know, who's been too friendly with credit card companies, but is basically a liberal, you know, that kind of thing. And the fact that Elizabeth Warren and all, you know, isn't the Treasury Secretary, but Janet Yellen is, that Biden seems to have a clear understanding that his political interests are in at least being perceived as the reasonable, moderate centrist. I think that's reflected for the most part in his cabinet picks so far. And I got to keep in mind, he doesn't have much of a mandate. I mean, I know that once you get in, everyone wants to claim he has a mandate. But, you know, his mandate was to be not Donald Trump. He's going to fulfill that the day he's inaugurated. Part of his mandate was to take the pandemic seriously, which conservatives should not have a problem with, for God's sake. And then the other thing is this sort of touchy-feely Hallmark Channel healing thing. And I don't know what that's actually going to mean in terms of policy, but everything else is going to be a negotiation. Everything else is going to be a normal political argument, and that alone will be refreshing. And I think that the people who want to go to total war, go to the mattresses against Joe Biden from day one, are making a terrible political blunder, because so far, at least, he has done nothing that seems like he deserves that kind of retaliation. And you just don't want to be, you don't, the war right now for the brands of these two parties is which one can seem like the grown-up reasonable party. And right now the Democrats are running away with that. And I think Joe Biden at least understands that. I'm not sure everybody in his party does, but I think he does.
Jonah, thank you.
It's great to be here. Thank you, Diane.
That was Jonah Goldberg, editor-in-chief of The Dispatch. And that's all for today. Thanks to those of you who've reached out to let me know what you'd like me to cover during these very difficult times. Please continue to let us know what's on your mind. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Our engineer is Mike Kidd. Thanks for listening, all. And please remember to wear those masks, keep yourself safe, and those you love. I'm Diane Reed.